to the first, the fourth session in the sixth session series on moving evidence into practice put on by the BCRSRNet. And today our speaker is Dr. Wendy Hall from the UBC School of Nursing. She has an extensive background in qualitative research. She's currently teaching a course in research methods. She's involved in interdisciplinary workshops and interested in facilitating interdisciplinary work and mentoring opportunities. So that certainly fits in with coming here to talk to a group of occupational therapists and physiotherapists. She's a reviewer on the International Journal of Qualitative Methods and Qualitative Health Research. Her research interests are in data interpretation, reflexivity, teamwork, and rigor in qualitative research methods. She's got multiple publications and grants, and so we're very fortunate to have her speak to us today looking at qualitative research. Help me welcome Dr. Wendy Hall.
Thanks, Andy. So it's a pleasure to be here with you today, and I know this is going to be podcast, so if I stumble every so often, it's because I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, this could be like for posterity or something, but I'll get over it. So this presentation today is called Qualitative Research, Purpose and Central Elements, and I've already been introduced, so I won't get into that. But I wanted to just review with you the purpose of what I'm trying to accomplish today, and that is to provide you with knowledge about qualitative research to support your evidence-based practice, and to assist you in thinking about ways you might frame clinical problem questions from a qualitative perspective. So that's what I'm hoping we'll accomplish, because my understanding is that, well, I know that in March you'll be working with Dr. Judy Lineham, and she'll be taking you through how to critique a qualitative article. So I didn't plan on doing that with you today. What I plan to do is give you some of the theoretical background you need so you can understand what you're doing when you start to go through a qualitative article and think about how to take it apart and how to critique it. Does that work for everybody? Okay, good. Okay, so I won't even pretend to know anything about occupational or physiotherapy literature. Okay, so I just want to make that clear from the outset. And I know that your past work has been around framing questions that you're going to ask of the literature and looking at the quantitative perspective. And I think you've had quite a few on that, haven't you? Three sessions? Oh, something like that.
Anyway. Yeah,
quantitative, right. So qualitative has this huge database. I mean, there's just tons of literature out there on it. So I'm barely going to scratch the surface. So what I'm going to try and do is just kind of do an overview of what I think you need to know about qualitative research. And I want you to think about what you've heard in some of your previous podcasts, because this is about integrating the best evidence into your practice, right? But qualitative research gives you a slightly different perspective on some of that evidence that you can integrate. And I know they talked in some of your previous podcasts about thinking about patient values and thinking about the perspectives of patients and the perspectives of expert clinicians. Does that ring a bell for people from previous? Okay. So it seems to me that qualitative research has a real strength in that area because it allows one to get at perspective and get at values and get at meanings. So that is one of its strengths, and we'll get into that in more detail. Okay. So I want you to think a little bit about your workplaces. I gather you're from all over the place. Some of you from BCH, some of you from Providence, some of you from PHSA. So talk to me a little bit about what you might want to know from your clinical settings about patients' perspectives. What are you interested in finding out about? Yeah.
Why recommendations aren't suiting the needs after the whole time.
So you're interested in looking at the interface between that assistive technology and the patients to see whether or not there's a fit. And if there's not a fit, does that potentially lead to this notion of abandonment or
right.
not complying with the treatment program?
Right.
Right, okay, that's really helpful. What, anybody else? Yeah?
I'd be interested in finding out people's perspectives going through the mental health system and how that relates to their experience of recovery.
Okay.
From illness.
So you're keen to look at what effect does going through the mental health system perhaps have on people's long-term recovery from mental illness, which is a very good question. And we'll come back to lots of the reasons for that later, as is yours, is a good question. And you have a question.
I work in an acute care setting, and we make all sorts of fabulous recommendations for people to follow once they're at home.
Mm-hmm.
And we really have no contact with them unless they're readmitted. And so I wonder how much of our fabulous recommendations are actually that good.
Right. So that would be a really good thing to know from a patient's perspective, right? We send you home with this great list of things that we think you ought to do. Do you end up doing any of it? And if you don't end up doing any of it, why is that the case?
Or and the ones that you do follow.
Why is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would be incredibly valuable information to get, wouldn't it? Okay. So you're getting into kind of the mindset that I'd like you to get into around thinking about qualitative research and what this can do. So really, what qualitative research can do is it can describe fundamental patterns of human thought and behavior. It takes context into consideration. And if you think about quantitative research, what's one of the things that we have to do with quantitative research in a way?
Add context.
Yeah, because especially if we're doing the dreaded or gold standard RCTs, they're supposed to take the context out of the picture, right? Or you're supposed to control for it as much as possible. So what qualitative work does is it adds it back in and requires you to have a look at it and think about how it might be affecting what's going on. Just as you raised from the questions you've said that you'd be interested in asking from your practice, because some of those things are around context, right? And also, it allows us to consider the social experience and how it's created and how it gives meaning. And so often that's process-oriented. And it's not easy to get at process with quantitative research, unless you plan to do longitudinal studies and you plan to do them over long time frames and then develop models or whatever to look at what people are doing. So qualitative research gives us an opportunity to think a little bit about how is experience created, what gives it meaning, how do people operate, and that can help us understand better what's going on. Okay. So I put this slide in because I think it's really useful for you to contemplate. Now, this is from a nursing textbook, Chin and Kramer, and it's about how we think about different ways of knowing. And of course, qualitative research would fit under the empiric way of knowing, because any kind of research would fit under that way of knowing. But in practice, which we all do, OTs and PTs and nurses all do practice, we also have to think about other kinds of knowing. We have to think about the personal knowing, the aesthetics of our practice, and also the ethics or the morality of our practice. And with qualitative research, you really do have to think about this. Because ethics is something that can unfold while you're doing your research. Like, if you think about it, normally when you're doing a quantitative project, you lay out your plan, you lay out your design, you have your questions that you're going to ask, you give them your questionnaires, they look at them, they decide yay or nay, and they give you permission to go ahead with your study. If you're doing a qualitative study and all you've got is some interview guide questions that are going to potentially direct where you might go with your interview, anything can happen when you get into that interview. Or when you're doing participant observation, if you're just in a setting watching what's going on, things can unfold that you don't expect. So you're having to make moral decisions a lot of the time when you're collecting your data. And that's where that ethical way of knowing comes in. Also, when you're the researcher, you're the research instrument. Everything gets channeled through you. And so it really is important to be reflective about that. Or what we call in qualitative work, reflexive. And that's where your personal ways of knowing come in. But also qualitative work can be very aesthetic. There's some forms of qualitative outcomes that are plays, or poetry, or films. So we also have to think a little bit about the aesthetic way of knowing in terms of what, how, is this inspiring? Is this, does this give us a message that we can take forward? How would we critique this from an aesthetic point of view? And we'll come back to that a little bit more later. But does that make sense for everybody in terms of thinking about those different ways of knowing and how they contribute? Okay, any questions about that? No? Okay. Okay. So this is a really simple list, which I have simplified, well, I've adapted from a nursing textbook that wants to, it's a qualitative textbook, so it's trying to illustrate the similarities, mostly differences, between qualitative and quantitative inquiry. And the problem with this is it is simplistic, and so it boils things down, right? And there's always problems when you create dichotomies. Because what happens when you start creating dichotomies? There's good and bad, yeah. But what else? Sorry?
They don't fit.
They don't fit. You lose a lot of information, don't you? Because you have to simplify it exactly to make it fit. And so you leave a lot of information out. So just take a look at that list and tell me what hits you when you read that list. You got the quantitative side and the qualitative side.
Well, each one is incomplete. So you would need really an integration of both of them to get a whole picture.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. And that is why a lot of people use multiple methods. What they do is they'll say to themselves, well, I could get my quantitative perspective, which is one perspective. I could get my qualitative perspective, which is a slightly different perspective. Imagine how much richer it would be if I put the two perspectives together. So that's a very creative way of looking at that list. Okay. How else can you look at the list?
Opposites.
Opposites, exactly. And what's the problem with opposites if we create that? Either or. It's, sorry?
Well, it's friction limits. I guess it's just.
Yeah, it can create friction. And you'd be amazed at the number of people who come up to me at conferences and say things like, wow, it's so good to, you know, that you're here because us qualitative researchers, we have to stick together, right? And I'll look at them and I'll say, no, I'm not a qualitative, I'm a researcher. I ask the questions that need to get asked. And if it's a qualitative question, I'll answer it with qualitative methods. And if it's a quantitative, you know, so don't try and put me in a camp because I'm not comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with asking the questions we need to ask and using the techniques we need to use to answer them. So what else do you get a sense of here? Anything else hit you?
You suggest the two are compatible.
It does, doesn't it? That they're incompatible. And there are qualitative theorists who take that position. I'm sure you probably know about them. Denzin and Lincoln are a classic case in point. They kind of put qualitative and quantitative into two different camps. And although they say they use quantitative methods, the way they present the paradigm of quantitative research is kind of deceptive and controlling and not very reflexive. And, you know, so if you start reading that, you're thinking, you know, don't want to have anything to do with that quantitative stuff. So that can be a problem with, you know, having lists like this. But still, they can be useful because they highlight differences. And they get you thinking about, well, why are these differences highlighted? What's this trying to tell me? So any other comments on that? Or is everybody comfortable? Yeah.
I'm not sure what the word I'm looking for, but it's almost like the one, the quantitative seems more kind of just cold and I'm just thinking of warm and cold because I sort of feel more warm and fuzzy on the qualitative side.
Good observation. There's a lot of people out there who regard qualitative research as being fuzzy and warm and soft.
And unscientific,
exactly. So there, on the one hand, it draws you in because it does give you that fuzzy, warm feeling because you're going to be going out and finding about people's perspectives and it's all going to be really interesting. But you've got some other people out there who say, oh, well, it's not. I was in an audience once when the CIHR came to talk at UBC, and I was sitting behind two guys, and they were, sorry, it's not gender specific, okay, it could have been two women. But I was sitting behind two researchers who will remain genderless, and the two researchers said, oh, look at this, they're funding that qualitative garbage. How can they even be sitting in the room? You know, like, it's just so not scientific. So that wasn't that long ago. So there's still people out there who do take the view that it's soft and it's not scientific. And so, you know, it can be a little tricky sometimes trying to communicate that it has its uses. Yeah.
Well, I think too, just from different funding sources, have very specific ideas about what is kind of the best way to do the research, and that's still there.
Yeah, funding sources have specific views about what's the best way to do research, and also some of the people who sit on review boards don't know a lot about some kinds of methods, and so they may have particular biases about them, and it's not just qualitative. It may be other methods too that they don't know that much about, right? So sometimes you're coming up against those barriers if you decide you want to do that kind of research. Yeah.
I often think of, if you're going to make kind of a high stakes decision, that it would, it's just personal. I always think maybe it's not enough to have just the qualitative. If it's a high stakes decision that's going to get made as a result of what you're finding, then you should really have some good quantitative stuff there.
Okay, that's a really valuable point to bring forward. So you're saying, if you really want to make a high stakes decision and you really want to pin something major on it, shouldn't there be some quantitative information and not just qualitative information?
It is qualitative. Can you design the study well enough so that qualitative would be enough?
Would be adequate.
Yeah. Even if you're going to make something that's going to have a big impact on that decision.
Yeah, okay. So we're talking about a whole bunch of things here, aren't we? We're talking about adequacy of design, we're talking about the kind of research you use, and we're talking about how big is the impact going to be. And we'll come back to that. So I'm going to make you wait for a little while, in suspense. Yes?
I've also kind of heard that you use qualitative more to be kind of exploratory and kind of when you're starting into a topic, and then once you kind of have more sort of data or kind of more sense of where the trends are, then you can kind of go more to the quantitative and kind of using it in that way.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the gaps that qualitative research can respond to. So that's a very astute observation. If it is exploratory and you don't really know what's going on, it doesn't make a lot of sense to ask a quantitative question because you don't even know what variables are involved. So what's the point of going out there and trying to measure them if you don't know what they are, right? Having said that, qualitative research can also make a contribution in areas where we have a lot of theory, but people are taking issue with the theory that's been developed. I think of one of my own graduate students who was working with children who lived with parents with mental illness, and she had a real issue about the resilience literature and how that theory's been developed and how it holds out this notion of what's a resilient child. And when we did her research, I was her chair, what we discovered was some of these kids were incredibly resilient who didn't have any of the characteristics that they normally hold out as, you know, indicating they're resilient in the literature, or how theoretically we would think about it. So what her research did was it provided a different perspective on what this resilience could look like. And it wasn't coming so much from the you do well at school and you get top marks model, and you don't cry. It was coming from a different perspective. So that it can be quite useful there too. Okay, so have we pretty much beaten this one to death? Shall we move on? Okay, so one of the things that qualitative work can do is it can address the gap between RCTs and clinical decision making. I'm sure you've spent quite a bit of time talking about RCTs in this group, and Cochrane's database, and why Cochrane's database came about. He was interested in efficiency and effectiveness, and he considers RCTs the best way to go there. But what are some of the limitations to RCTs? What are RCTs intended to do? Yes, so we're looking at an average, we're looking at a mean, right? And what are they trying to speak to? Are they trying to speak to particular cases? No, so what are they trying to speak to?
General, to predictability, to if you do this, this should happen the most.
Yeah, so they want to get into predictability, they want to be generalizable. And really, they're talking about things at the population level. They're not talking about things at the individual level. But we all know that when we practice with people, we're practicing you and me, one-on-one with the person we're practicing with, right? And that our work has to acknowledge the uniqueness of the people we're practicing with. And RCTs aren't designed to do that. RCTs are designed to give you sort of a global perspective about this treatment works with this particular group of people under these particular sets of circumstances. But it may well not work with the population or the person, sorry, that you're happening to work with, because they may not quite fit into that population of people that the RCT's been done on. So what qualitative work can do is it can help you address that gap between what RCTs are telling you is the best evidence and your clinical decision making. Because it can help us get at those perspectives that you were bringing up earlier that can explain for you why, after an RCT has been done and it's shown that assistive technology is the cat's meow in terms of interventions, that you have situations where you use it with people and it doesn't work, right? So that can be very useful. Also, qualitative research can be very helpful in helping us with gaps in understanding about the effects of social systems, social relations, or social interactions, because it's very process-oriented. And it looks at context very seriously. And there are many methods that are particularly designed to look at context and to take them into consideration when you're developing your findings. So that you really have to pay attention to what is going on around these people and not just at the level of the individual. So it can be useful for that. It can also be useful in helping us get at care in terms of equity. What do you think I mean by the word equity? Equality, yeah. Yeah.
Even if some things are easy to study by RCT, so they get studied to death, and some areas don't fit the RCT, so they just don't get studied.
Yeah, that's a really important point. There's lots of things that you can't do easily with an RCT. The interventions are supposed to be short, they're supposed to be clean, you're supposed to be able to put people in a control group and an experimental group. Some things don't lend themselves to putting people in control groups. So that can be an issue around what gets studied and what doesn't. But I'm also, yeah? Exactly, and PAR is a really good example, participatory action research, of how you can get at people's perspectives around are things accessible to them? Are things equally useful for them? And if they're not accessible and they're not useful, then we've got a problem with equity, right? Because not everybody's getting access to the same things in the system. So that's something that qualitative research can be very useful in helping us do. And as I said earlier, gaps in theories or questions about existing theories, qualitative research can help us with that. If we're not happy with what the theories about resilience are doing, we can go study other populations qualitatively and try and get a better sense of what's operating here around resilience and critique how people have handled resilience. Because that's tended to be handled almost totally quantitatively and not very much qualitatively. And then also, theories can be developed in the sense, because grounded theory, which is one of the qualitative methods, is looking at how do we develop mid-range theories. And out of grounded theory study, you should be able to get a mid-range theory. And there's also people who do meta-analysis of qualitative studies, right? And so what they're doing is they're taking the qualitative studies and they're looking across those studies that have been done in similar areas. I don't mean contextually, but I mean a similar question about which they're trying to find an answer. And they've looked across the studies to see, is there anything from all of these qualitative studies that we can pull so we can develop kind of a more formal theory about what might be going on here that's less contextual. Not acontextual, but less contextual. Less contextually bound. Does that make sense for everybody? Yeah. Okay. Any questions about that? No? Okay. Are you ready to move on? Okay. So the contributions are to help us with clinical improvisation, to give us an opportunity to think about how we can improvise clinically through qualitative data, to help us understand more about the cultures of healthcare, because cultures in healthcare are important. We see them operating every single day. I had one of my students in my office yesterday, and she was just about in tears. She's just finishing up a study looking at nurses, patients, and families and how they come together to try and collaborate around care. And she came up with a theory she's calling progressively engaging, But she's also in the clinical area with students, and she was watching yesterday one nurse just demolish another nurse. Just demolish them. And I don't think that's, I don't want to be nurse bashing, because that could happen equally in any professional group. But it was one of those situations where the place was crazy, there was a real shortage of staff, people were running around trying to, you know, meet the needs of the patients, and this nurse just decided to take this other nurse on because, you know, she felt that she was trying too hard to overcome the structural features that were operating. Well, if we don't take the structural features into account, we always end up blaming individuals for what's happening in settings, right? And that's where qualitative research can be quite valuable, because it not only takes the structural features into account, but it also explains to us how they operate, how they influence these interactions among people in these settings, which can be not very nice sometimes. So that's important. And they help us understand the meanings and actions people take in response to those cultural settings in which they find themselves, or in response to each other. And, as I've already said, they help us extend our theories of phenomena. So either developing new theory from areas we haven't been before, or changing the way we think about existing theories, or some other elements of theories that might be out there. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. And then they can give us a new way of thinking about the meanings around phenomena, because let's face it, things change over time. 10 years ago, would you have thought that people would be in practice working with PDAs? Who'd ever heard of a PDA 10 years ago? So the meaning around communication, the meaning around charting, the meaning around accessing technology has changed significantly in the last 10 years. And qualitative research allows us to account for some of those changes over time and revisit what those things mean to people as things change and time marches on. So we're all dealing with that on an ongoing basis. Okay, so let's think a little bit about theory. How's everybody doing? Do you need to get up and move around, or no? Okay. So let's think a little bit about theory. Qualitative research can start from a theoretical perspective. And you're probably sitting here thinking, well, what on earth is she on about? Why would we care if qualitative research starts from a theoretical perspective? But I think it's kind of important, because actually, if you come right down to it, all research starts from a theoretical perspective. We're all walking around out there with a set of assumptions or a theory we're working from, and that's what's driving the questions we ask and the research we do. But a lot of the time, nobody is clear about what those things are. They're implicit, they're not explicit. And if you keep it implicit, then nobody understands how it's operating. So it's really important, particularly in qualitative research, to make any theories that you're operating from explicit, not implicit. Because it has implications. Whoa. Okay.
Code blue, temp bravo, code blue, temp bravo, code blue, temp bravo.
Let's hope that person does okay. Okay, so you can start from a theoretical perspective, and say you start from a feminist theoretical perspective. Say it's standpoint feminism. So you've said, as a standpoint feminist, I'm interested in questions about women, for women, because I'm interested in dealing with women's oppression, okay? So that's then going to have implications for the kind of question you ask, where you find your sample, who you let into your sample, because if it's for women and about women, it might only be women that you decide to let into your sample. What you decide your outcomes are going to be, because if you're a standpoint feminist, you're into emancipatory activities. So it's not enough just to come up with some result from your qualitative study. You're supposed to also be contributing to the emancipation of women, which is a pretty tall order when you think about it. So you need to make your theoretical assumptions explicit in terms of how they're driving your research and how they're operating. It doesn't mean it's biasing it, because everybody started from a theoretical perspective or set of theoretical assumptions. All you're doing is making it clear to people that in fact you are and how it is actually operating. So in a sense, it's better to do that than to leave it implicit and have nobody know what's going on. Does that make sense for everybody? Yeah? Okay. So we've already said that qualitative research can contribute mid-range theory. Now, there's a lot of talk that goes on about, well, what is mid-range theory? And how applicable, we won't use the word generalizable, is mid-range theory. Because people go out and they do grounded theory studies and they come up with what they call mid-range theory. Have you used any grounded theory studies results in your practice?
No.
Yeah.
I've heard the term thrown around, but I'm clear as to the difference between that and some of the other qualitative methods. So
okay. Okay, well, we'll go into that in more depth, but really what they're arguing with grounded theory in terms of mid-range theories is they're saying, well, it's not formal theory, so it's not acontextual. It's not like roles. If you think about role theory, it's kind of acontextual, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're in the U.S. or Canada or Australia or maybe even Africa. If you're thinking about roles, everybody kind of has an understanding of what that term means. And so in that sense, it's a formal theory and it's quite acontextual. But when you think about a mid-range theory, you're saying, well, this is a theory that operates in a kind of a particular kind of context. And we're not saying that it only applies to the people that we develop the theory with, but we're saying it's got limited application. So I'll give you an example. The student I was talking about, who did her study with kids who were living with parents with mental illness, came up with two core processes, because you're supposed to have a core variable in grounded theory, and we went for broken head, two. And one was, I can't believe I'm having a mental block here about this. Anyway, one was thinking about, finding the frame. So that was one piece of it. And the other piece of it was, working around the relationship. So there was finding the frame, and I can't remember what the terminology was we used for the first one, because it's been a while since we worked on that together. And the two things came together. So the finding the frame piece was where the children had to think about, okay, I want a relationship with this parent with mental illness, but what do I have to do to protect myself? How do I stay a whole person in this? But on the other side of this double helix was the keeping the relationship or maintaining the relationship with the parent, which the children would go to great lengths to do because they wanted to stay with their parents. So these two things were coming together in terms of explaining how the children operated and what they did and why they used the strategies they used. So you could look at that and say, well, you know, it was done with kids who were living with parents with mental illness between the ages of 6 and 16. And they were in a prairie city, so maybe it's not applicable to Vancouver. But often you would probably find, if you went out and talked to kids who were living with parents with mental illness, it probably would be applicable to Vancouver. And you could say, well, you know, maybe it's only applicable to parents who are living with depression. And it's not applicable to parents who are living with schizophrenia, because she had a smaller number of people who had schizophrenia. But then they only account for, 1 to 2% of the population with mental illness, so there's not so many of them out there. So it's that question about, well, if it's a mid-range theory, to what group is it applicable and to what group isn't it? And we'll come back and talk about that. But there's no claim being made that it's applicable to every kid out there living with a parent with mental illness in any place, anytime, anywhere. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like some things would just kind of so outweigh that it would make the mid-range be more extensive.
Yeah, it's always a little hard to call, isn't it? Because it depends. That's why you need some description about where the data were generated and what was going on. Because if most of the variables in your theory, your mid-range theory, are about what you do in relationship to your parent, then it kind of doesn't matter whether it's rural or urban, right? But there was another piece to this theory where we were looking at the whole notion of these social structural features, one being the school system, and whether kids fit in the school system or not. And so that would be a little different, perhaps, if you were in a rural than an urban area. So that's a really good question. And you have to really pay attention to the details so that you can kind of make a reasoned decision about how applicable that would be in other settings. Does that make sense for everybody? Yeah. So those are the kinds of things we have to be thinking about when we're reading qualitative research. It's, yeah. And then we already said that this meta-analysis can contribute to these grand theories, but again, you have to be careful, because when you're doing meta-analysis with quantitative research, you're looking at things like effect sizes, right? And you're looking at whether populations are comparable or not before you include those in your meta-analysis. And so when you're doing qualitative meta-analysis, it's a similar kind of principle. You've got to make sure you're not putting apples and oranges together. You have to at least be putting apples and sort of apples together, or slightly different apples. So we need to attend to, if people say they're doing a meta-analysis of qualitative work, what bits did they put together to come up with that meta-analysis? And how formal a theory do we really think that might be? Or do we think it's still quite contextually bound? Because remember back to our list, one of the things that was the strength of qualitative research was that it took into account context, right? So when you start to move to meta-analysis, you're making trade-offs, right? You're making a trade-off between taking context into account with being able to say that this thing may be applicable to more people. So we're always making trade-offs in research. And we need to, you know, be clear that we are doing that some of the time. Okay, is everybody clear on that? There's no, didn't lose anybody there? Okay, so now we're going to get down to the qualitative approaches and what the similarities and differences are. So basically, every qualitative approach, if you want to really get down to basics, it looks at meanings, and it looks at meanings attached to behaviors, thoughts, experiences. They all do that. But some methods are a lot more interested in that than other methods. So if you think about phenomenology or content analysis, depending on the kind of phenomenology you're using, there's two different kinds of phenomenology. There's descriptive and there's interpretive. Descriptive phenomenology is interested in getting at a notion of essence. So it is a lot more, in a way, quantitative. Why would I say that? Why would I say it's more quantitative if it wants to get at essence?
Because you're supposed to get to the basic nature of something that would be more generalized, more universal.
Exactly, you got it in one. When you get to essence, you're getting to what's at the core of this that isn't necessarily contextually bound, that we could say is universal. So if you get at the essence of motherhood, or the essence of, give me an example from your practice, the essence of, okay, patient-therapist interaction, then you're trying to get at something that is captures the core of it, that is in a way acontextual. And what descriptive phenomenologists would say is you have to bracket your assumptions and your previous knowledge about something. So they would say you have to take it and put it in a box and put it aside and try and get at this whole notion of essence. Which kind of undermines that idea that we had earlier when we talked about personal knowledge and being reflexive, right? Because do you think any of us can ever take our thoughts and our previous experience and put it in a box and put it to one side? It's pretty tough to do, right? So that's kind of close to this quantitative idea in a way, isn't it? But it's interested in getting at meaning and experience, but essence of it. Whereas interpretive phenomenology is more interested in meanings but not at essence. It's interested in looking at meanings in the particular context in which they're generated. So there's different kinds of phenomenology. Content analysis, which people give a rough ride. People are mean about content analysis. What do you think, what's your reaction to content analysis when I mention that? Does everybody know what content analysis is?
No.
No, okay. Content analysis is when you say see, I use the word just. Okay, I stopped myself. Content analysis is when you say you're going to do a descriptive qualitative study, and you're going to go and collect data, and then you're going to examine those data for the themes out of the data. So there's no fancy talk about, you know, phenomenology from a philosophical perspective and bracketing and all that other stuff, and there's no fancy talk about theoretical sampling and all the things that go around along with ground theory. It is simply, not just, it is simply following through from the question to collecting the data to doing your content analysis. It is a very, very valuable method. And I have a lot of graduate students who use content analysis because you can collect a lot of data, you can work it through and do an inductive analysis of it, so you're looking through the data for themes, and it can be very, very useful in terms of explaining what's going on or giving some descriptions of what's going on. And content analysis is very interested in this idea of meanings and attached to behaviors and experiences, like phenomenology. But it's not coming from a philosophical perspective. It's more of a method. If we think about processes associated with managing problems, then we're getting into grounded theory. If you think about processes associated with managing problems, then we're getting into grounded theory. So that thing I told you about with my student working on that, with maintaining the frame, oh, and finding the rhythm. I knew I'd think of the other part. So finding the rhythm was on the relationship side, and maintaining the frame was on the other side, in terms of trying to keep myself together as a human being. And that those two processes were how the kids managed living with a parent with a mental illness. Okay? So it's an example of finding a theory that explains how you manage for them that was a problem. You know, it would have been a lot easier for them if they'd been living with a healthy parent, right? But they weren't, and so they had to deal with it. So grounded theory is very interested in explaining how people process problems by coming up with this overriding concept that pulls all the little baby concepts together and explains how people work through a process. Does that make sense to everybody? Yeah? Okay. Okay. So if we think about maximizing understanding of context, then we're getting more into thinking about culture and thinking about what's happening structurally where people find themselves. And grounded theory is supposed to take structure into consideration, but people don't always do that when they're doing grounded theory. Some people do and some people don't. And that can be a criticism of some work that calls itself grounded theory that doesn't look at context. But for sure, if you're doing an ethnographic study, you're interested in the context, because ethnography came out of anthropology, which is culture, right? And so that's all about wanting to understand how culture operates, what are the signifiers of that culture, what are the symbols of that culture, how do people live in that culture, how do they work through whatever cultural things are going on for them. And we don't have to necessarily think about culture as going off to Central America and studying people who are off in the middle of the jungle and don't have contact with anybody else. We can think of culture as studying what happens in a healthcare environment, or what happens, in a small town or something like that. Yeah. Or in the downtown east side, exactly. Because that's got its whole own culture associated with it, right? So, you know, we can think about culture in a fairly flexible way. And historical studies are really important because they're looking at how has context, culture, structure changed over time. So I'm working with a student right now who's doing a major paper, and she's looking at the whole question of how technology around childbirth has changed over time and how it's been introduced into childbirth, and particularly from the standpoint of this notion of the elective cesarean section. You know, the freedom to choose, they like to frame this debate as. So she's looking at that whole question around how has this inserted itself into our childbirth culture? How has this technology changed over time? And what's our understanding of that technology now? And how does it operate as a feature of our culture? But there's other methods that are also interested in explaining the effects of structures in history, but from a more critical perspective. So if we think about critical ethnography, that's when you take critical theory and you combine it with ethnography, and you're looking very critically at how structures have influenced people over time. So you're very interested in things like racialization, oppression. You're interested in groups that have been colonized. So a lot of people who do critical ethnography would call themselves post-colonialists, right? Because they're interested in what happens after groups have been colonized by other groups. So it's very much around questions of power, how power is expressed through structures, how people are affected by that power and which people are on the winning side of the power relations and which people aren't on the winning side of the power relations. And with a primary objective of exposing that so that there's a possibility for emancipation or some change in those oppressive features that are operating. Narrative is interested in that too, but it's interested in it more from the perspective of storytelling and from the perspective of discourses that have developed over time. We might have discourses about film. We might have discourses about, help me out here, what's another example?
Language.
Okay. Do you have discourses that you think have changed over time in OT and PT? What would those be? Models of practice, yeah, that's a good one. What other ones do you think?
Places of practice.
Places of practice, yeah. And maybe even how we think about our patients in our practice has changed over time, right? Because now we're moving into this whole thing about patient-centered practice. Whatever, you know, people understand that to mean. It doesn't always seem like it's patient-centered practice, but that's the model we're all supposed to be moving into. So it's a question of, well, how has that discourse been framed? Where is that discourse coming from? Who's being served by that discourse? Who's not being served by that discourse? What are the implications of that discourse for how we practice and how we work? Yeah?
I was just thinking of another advanced practice, which
it's
one that seems to be just thrown out constantly.
Yeah. Best practice and evidence-based practice. It's like the Bible now, right? You know, I mean, it is. It's just everywhere. But a lot of times people don't define what they mean by best practice or evidence-based practice, and there might be privileging of some evidence and not privileging of other evidence, and then you're kind of left with the question of, well, what does this really mean for my practice? And what about if I don't consider it to be good evidence? Yeah, actually translating to best practice. So all of those discourses are out there and they influence us, and we really need to think about how they're influencing us if we're interested in looking at it from a narrative or critical research perspective, because that's about unpacking all of this and trying to understand how does it operate and what effects is it having on us. It's kind of fun to do, but you have to be prepared to come face to face with what you might unpack, because you can't always pack it back up again. Okay, and then there's PAR, which was mentioned earlier, participatory action research. And there's different ways of talking about participatory action research, but basically, it's about trying to take people's experiential knowledge and take it through a series of steps where you move from experiential, which is kind of pre-language, to presentational, which is attaching concepts to it, to propositional, which is relating the concepts to each other. You think about a proposition, that's what it's doing. To actually get into the place where you're starting to look at practical knowledge. So how do we move from experiential knowledge to practical knowledge in a way that works for participants? And in PAR, the participants are part of the research team. So they're not people we go work on. I was going to use the preposition on. I don't think that's quite the right preposition. But they are integral to the research, to coming up with the questions, to what you do about your methods, to how you analyze the data. They're part of the whole process. Now, that's an interesting thing, because PAR sounds on the face of it like, wow, we should all be doing that, and we should all be out there doing PAR. But there's some people who really resist getting involved to that level. And you'll hear people say, well, I was trying to do PAR, but after we collected the data, when I went to the participants and said, okay, let's analyze this together, they said, no, you're the researcher, that's your job. That's not my job to analyze the data, you go do it. Creates a little problem when you claim to be doing PAR and they don't want to get involved in the analysis. Yeah. So it's an interesting method and it has much promise, but every so often you run up against a few little barriers along the way too. Okay, I think we should get up, move around for a minute, and then we'll move on to the next thing, okay? Because I sense flagging in the energy level.